Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all race and creed, welcome back to the Merrick versus Wyszynski podcast. After a brief summer respite, your boys are back on the sticks, and I'll give you some breaking news, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, what's up?
One of us has had a dramatic life change since we last spoke to you.
It's true. I interviewed 2015 NHL prospect Noah Hanifin, soon to be of Boston College. Sorry, Quebec Ramparts. That's what you're talking about, right?
It's true. I had it lopped off. Sorry, Rudy. No, I of course talking about the holiest of holy matrimonies.
Listen, man, it was like such a formality and almost just sort of like an afterthought. It took like a cozy 10 minutes. It was like immediate family in the backyard, and then all we did was chase kids all afternoon long, and that was it. Oh, by the way, man, quick plug for Feel Good Guru, Queen Street, across from one of our favorite parks in the city of Toronto. Awesome place to cater the whole thing. Feel Good Guru online at Feel Good Guru. Some of the finest raw vegan food you will ever have, Greg Wyszynski.
I was really hoping that plug was going to be, and just wanted to give a shout out to 10-Minute Weddings Are Us over on...
That'd be Vegas. Drive-through wedding.
Yeah,
pick up
exactly.
a couple of Tim Hortons double-doubles, and here, exchange your rings.
Who would be the person dressed like at a quickie Toronto wedding chapel? I mean, obviously in Vegas, it's Elvis. Who would it be in Toronto if you went to the quickie chapel?
Are you familiar with the mayor? Are you familiar with Mr. Ford? Have you not... I mean, the legend continues to grow. Like, honestly, like, the guy, and I'm not the biggest supporter, although I keep myself at arm's length considering I live in Stouffville and no longer part of the jurisdiction of my favorite 416, but still, like, the guy, like, he defines the epitome of falling upwards. Like, there is no scandal this guy cannot recover from. And
that's
you
the
saw
greatest
Ford,
idea.
Ford Fest last week. So, listen, man, if Ford doesn't win the election next fall, he could get into quickie weddings like quick as Jack the Bear.
That's the greatest thing ever. The idea of Rob Ford doing 10-minute weddings, but he passes out 8 minutes into it. He's just on the floor. You look over from, and you're like, what happened? Are we married technically? Did he get to that part? A lot of interesting things happening in Canada, actually. A lot of interesting things. Saturday night.
Like what?
Montreal, Just for Laughs Festival. Seth Rogen has the most Canadian moment in the history of Canada, or moments, bringing out Canadian flags, bringing out a wheelbarrow of Timbits, and bringing out the Stanley Cup, and bringing out PK Subban with two pitchers of beer.
A replica Stanley Cup. And a replica ambassador from the Hockey Hall of Fame. Right. And everyone lost their mind over it.
Let's get into this first off. Okay.
All right.
Nobody lost their mind over it. Everybody was like, oh, he touched it. First debate was, should Seth Rogen be able to drink from the Stanley Cup? And of course he should be able to. He's a Hollywood actor. And as you know, if you're a Hollywood actor, you can touch, drink from, and spend a day with the cup as per the rules of bandwagonism. It's just the way it works. Everybody in LA gets a day with the cup. That's how big the bandwagon is. The second thing is, we make no secret of the fact that we love PK Subban on this podcast. He's a past and future guest.
Yeah.
We love him, what he brings to the table. He's an electrifying player and even more electrifying personality. But what he did was ingenious. I mean, let's erase the idea that it's a replica cup. Let's just say that no matter what kind of cup it is, you wouldn't want any player to fuss with it because you don't want to anger the hockey gods. What he essentially did was not touch the cup but drink from it by using a gigantic novelty straw. I thought that was ingenious.
But unless,
of course, like we wrote on Puck Daddy, unless, of course, you believe that the liquid contained within the bowl of the cup, and this is much like Catholicism in which water is transformed into the blood of Christ. If you believe that the liquid contained in the top of the Holy Grail of hockey is then transformed, is then something that carries forth the hex, the curse, the bad juju, well, then he would be in trouble, wouldn't he?
Is this like what happened to all the archaeologists that opened King Tut's tomb? And all of a sudden, all of them sort of befell disease and all passed away. Is that kind of what you're getting
also,
at? Like, unless you win it. Like, you have the magic key once you've won it. Then you can drink the elixir from the top of the cup. But if you haven't actually won the thing, this is such hogwash.
Right,
this
exactly.
This is where sports gets really dumb and really stupid.
Why? Oh, I disagree.
Completely artificial, little goofy traditions. Don't walk on the logo and all that crap, too, and don't drink
from the cup. Oh, well, you know how I feel.
Oh, don't even touch the cup.
That's a horseshit tradition. That's a horseshit tradition. The Stanley Cup itself is like the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, there are ghosts that circle this thing. It's a supernatural, iconic thing. And frankly, the comparison you're trying to draw is when that Nazi sympathizer in The Last Crusade tried to drink from the wrong Holy Grail, and then he aged like 10,000 years in 2 seconds and died horrifically.
That's pretty cool.
No,
yeah, pretty
cool. I'm somebody who believes in the superstitions of the cup, and that's why I give PK credit. Like, I think he found a loophole around the wrath of the hockey gods by using
a
novelty straw to drink out of it. Yeah.
You don't think that the hockey gods look at it and say, hey, man, it's a bogus technicality? No way, sir. Like, if the hockey gods are that strong on this affront to hockey decency, I don't think a straw is going to be the caveat that breaks it. I'm sorry.
Here's the actual thing I feel about the cup, okay? Even this being a replica cup, even if the replica cup they used on stage had a giant effing neon sign on the front that said, fake cup, fake cup, fake cup. I would still have a problem with my guy picking it up. Like, that's how superstitious I am about the cup
thing.
I wouldn't want my guy to touch it or even look at it. I wouldn't want it at all. I really feel that way about the cup. There are many superstitions in hockey that I agree with you are horseshit. The logo on the floor, it's horseshit. It's stupid. You know what it is? It's crowd control. But the cup itself... The cup itself is sacred.
Ah, see, I don't hold it as sacred as you do, nor do the players that get it, and it turns up in either the bottom of left wingers for the Edmonton Oilers pool or second line center from the Edmonton Oilers escorting it to strip joints. I'm sorry. If this cup is sacred, it wouldn't have been to half the places it's been to. So let's not get into the, oh my goodness, he drank from the cup. You know how many outrageous, over-the-top, sundry things have been done with that cup? For hockey players to put forward that it is somehow sacred, considering what has been done to it, including leaving it at the side of the road for over a day once, I'm just not buying it, Wish.
But that's what you miss. That's what you don't understand. All those people that had the cup and did all of these heinous things with it, okay?
Yeah.
The cup was in their possession. Do you understand that the cup is like Thor's hammer Mjolnir?
So once you have it, it's free pass.
You
do
are
whatever you want with it.
It is indestructible. You are indestructible. I think we've talked about this on the show before. The cup itself is a skeleton key. It gets you into any place you ever wanted to get
into.
That's true. It's made of magic.
That is 100% true. There is no line too long. There is no club or restaurant too exclusive. When you show up in the cup, you can show up in Daisy Duke's so tight you can tell what religion you are, and you can still walk into any restaurant and boss around a waiter.
It's like the Seinfeld where Costanza dates a model and all of a sudden starts getting invited to the model parties because by proxy he's cool enough to be there. That's how it is. Everything you've ever wanted to do. You could probably, I don't know if this is provable, but I bet you could probably get inside the cockpit of a spacecraft with a Stanley
Cup.
Wow. Yes.
Wow. That would really be something. Well, you know what? Who really lost? Because I was looking online too when it happened. I didn't necessarily see anyone specifically who lost their minds about it.
Nobody
it seemed
did.
Like a good story, like, oh, yeah. Wow, let's create a phony little, you know, we're so bored here at the end of July in Hockey Universe. Let's create a little phony story. How dare PK Subban do that?
Nobody had a problem.
I didn't really see it, though.
Well, like Dave Stubbs had to do a preventive strike on Twitter. Dave Stubbs, the great Gazette beat writer who's also a longtime member of the wrestling community, which blows my mind every time we speak about it.
And former WWF referee.
Yeah, it's insane. Oh, by the way, poor little out for TNA today, evidently, according to
TMZ.
That.
Spike, yeah.
Spike is not renewing Impact Wrestling. Dave Stubbs had to tweet that it was, in fact, a replica cup, I guess to try to head off the controversy at the pass. I mean, it is July. It happened on a Saturday night. The news cycle was starting to churn a little bit more, and they had to, calm everybody down. But, again, I don't think it was a real controversy. And, again, PK used the giant novelty straw, so that
he
was
used
really
a straw.
Fantastic. What do you think happens arbitration-wise this week with him, by the way? What's your insight on that?
I can't see it going to arbitration. I really can't. Like, if it goes to arbitration, Montreal is going to get killed, and then the bad blood really starts. I mean, it sort of percolated a little bit during the last lockout where you saw PK Subban, throughout it. He said all the right things, and he was as diplomatic and charming as he could be. But, he was a little bent out of shape about what happened last time around. I think when you go into that room, that's what I always say, like, guys are scared of that room, and they should be scared of that room. Like, it is rare, the hockey player that wants to go into that room. It is frightening. To hear your general manager, representative of your team, tear down your game and talk about why you are not worth that money. Man, that's tough to come back from.
Yeah.
I know we're all, all grown-ups and all big boys and big boy pants and all that kind of stuff, man, but those words hurt. And that's why I can't see it getting to arbitration. But if it does, holy smokes, that will be the story of the summer.
Yeah, I can't imagine
what PK Subban gets and what Marc Bergevin says about PK Subban in that room. You want HBO 24/7 access? Give me the Arb room. Give me the PK Subban here.
I got to imagine they'll settle on a 2-year deal, a little 2-year bridge deal. Cap
and you know what?
Exploded in the next couple of years.
Well, that's it. Like, if you're like, even if you're Newport Sports, okay, like if you're Don Meehan, PK Subban's agent, aren't you perhaps looking at the landscape and saying, you know what? We're not going anywhere. PK Subban's still going to be an outstanding player in the NHL and only getting better. Why max out now when the cap is around 70 when we can max out when the cap is at 80 or 85 and there's more room and more dollars involved? I'm with you, Wish. Like, if I'm Camp Subban, looking at the skill set, looking at the landscape and what's on the horizon, man, 2-year deal ain't too bad for me.
Not bad.
And then you really ring the bell long term.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's where they go, and I think Montreal is insane if they don't go that route, because I don't think he's going to sign long term. I really don't. I mean, he might. The interesting thing about Subban remains that. Of all the players that give lip service about loving the team they play for, he's the one I actually believe. Like, I believe that there might not be another place in this league he'd rather be than Montreal. Like, I think he loves being a Hab.
Yeah.
Maybe turning heel and joining Boston if his brother ever made it to the bigs would be the thing that he would do. Maybe he would pull a Niedermeyer one day and want to play with his brother.
He's a showbiz guy. You know he'd love to go to Boston.
That would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
That would be the ultimate heel turn.
Speaking of 2-year contracts, another favorite of the show, at least on one side of the mic, Ryan O'Reilly. Yeah. 2 years, $12 million with the Colorado Avalanche to stave off arbitration. O'Reilly was looking for 1 year at 6.75. The Avs countered with a low ball of 5.525, which was the minimum. Based on the inflated salary O'Reilly had due to that offer sheet. Mm-hmm. O'Reilly made $6.5 million last season, gets a reduction of that salary that the Avs are looking for. None of this matters. He's gone anyway. I mean, right? I mean, it's all just delaying the inevitable. In fact, I mean, I would be shocked if he actually filled out and finished that second year of the contract, right?
Yeah, I think that and who knows? I mean, you got a couple years now to try to repair the relationship, but I'd be shocked if, by the end of this contract, Ryan O'Reilly is still a member of the Colorado Avalanche.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, winning changes a lot of things, and I'm sure we'll talk about what the stats community thinks about the Avs next season and moving forward, but that's still a really good young team, right? And that's a team that, despite what many will tell you, I still think is one that's going to be competitive next year in the Western Conference.
Well, it's funny how things kind of fit together on this show sometimes, and I think this is a good bridge to our guest who will be coming up shortly, Kyle Dubas, who is the assistant general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and of course a guy who is carrying the battle flag in some ways for the analytics community, a guy who has flaunted the fact that he works with analytics and now has gotten one of the more high-profile assistant GM gigs in this league. And part of his selling point was the fact that he is schooled in analytics. Your Colorado Avalanche thing brings up the point that this is one of those canaries in the coal mine about advanced stats. This is the hill a lot of people are willing to die on, and the idea that Colorado is going to come back next year and be dog shit because all of the analytics tell us that they were playing well above their heads last season in gaining that amazing success they had under Patrick Waugh in year one.
Yeah, save percentage was too high, shooting percentage was too high, Wheeler comes back down to earth. A lot of, now, in their defense, a lot of the same things were said about the Toronto Maple Leafs two seasons ago, and you know what? Yeah, they came back down to earth. You know, mind you, it was only that, you know, that half season you had to work with in the lockout shortened year, but stats community was bang on about the Toronto Maple Leafs. This will be the next litmus test. What happens with the Avalanche, because the stats community are saying, nah, these guys are looking or trending towards a colossal collapse next year. I don't know. I look at the roster and, you know, I look at the defense, right? Like, I don't think anyone really loves the Avalanche defense, right? Eric Johnson, Brad Stewart, that's good. Tyson Barry, Jan Hayda, you know, Nick Holden, Ryan Wilson, these. No one loves him. You like him, you just don't love him. The goaltender is all world. Can he maintain that high save percentage and that high performance level? I don't know. I would think so. And I would think players like Matt Duchene, Gabriel Landeskog, Nathan MacKinnon would still be evolving their game and growing their game. Don't necessarily like their bottom six, but are they poised for a huge sort of Sisyphean roll of the rock down the hill? I don't know that I go that far.
I think it's a good bet that they might. You know, if you think MacKinnon might drop a little bit sophomore year, he wouldn't be the first rookie star to do that. Well, you never know, right? If you think that the Stastny thing is going to impact them adversely, as far as maybe if somebody gets injured, now all of a sudden you're down to one good center instead of having a three-headed monster and having to start moving guys around that lineup a little bit. And then the other factor, obviously, is Varlamov, who had by far his best year as a pro last season, and thinking about how hard that's going to be, how hard it is for him to replicate that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the worst idea to hedge your bets and say they're not going to be as good as they were last year. I don't think that's a bad thought at all. And if that's the case, then you have some very prominent people, Dello, Lambert, yep, a number of other guys that have staked out since the last season wasn't even done yet, that Colorado was gonna fade pretty severely in the second year under Patrick Waugh. So it would definitely be a stamp on the resume if that happens for a lot of these guys.
Abs were my favorite team to watch last year. They're just a fun team to watch. This year they're going to be the most interesting team to watch, just to see who wins that bet, just to see who wins that payoff. And not that you can, you know, validate one side or the other based on one team, but that seems to be where the battleground is going to be. You know, interesting as well, I talked to Jamie McGinn at the Memorial Cup last year. He was there because, well, his brother was playing on the Guelph Storm, and also he was a member of the Ottawa 67s in 2005, played there at then John Labatt Center, now Budweiser Gardens. And I was asking him about playing man-to-man in their own zone. He said, yeah, you know, we got away with it for about half the season, and then everybody caught on. So we had to change and go to more sort of conventional styles. So we really saw Colorado play a couple of different styles. I'll be curious to see what Patrick Waugh throws at the NHL this year by way of style, because he went the junior hockey route, and it worked. Early on, we're playing man-to-man in our own zone. What is this, Quebec Ramparts or Quebec or Colorado Avalanche? Well, it was a little bit of junior hockey thrown in there. I'm curious to see what Roth throws at the NHL this year.
Indeed. And also, as you said, Colorado is going to be a fascinating and exciting team to watch no matter what, which is obviously why NBC has them on four fewer times than the Buffalo Sabres next year. Stay tuned for that discussion, by the way. We need to get to our guests, but first, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
You know, you can never have, you know, enough tails or tongues or ears or paws or whatever. This is what's called a radio hook. Hey, Jeff's got a question that's going to get you thinking. Stay tuned. Ooh. What is it? We'll find out in a moment.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I am so looking forward to taking Bailey's cream all over my face.
Whoa.
Hi, Mom.
Wow.
What did you say? Sorry, I had Jeff Merrick's pickle juice in my mouth.
Oh, my. Debate hockey.
Need to recharge?
I don't care.
Have some of Jeff Merrick's pickle juice.
Well, yesterday was Babcock cream. Today it's Merrick's pickle juice.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Well, I'm certainly happy that our guest today is a 28-year-old slickster whiz kid who will be down with all that potty humor in the intro.
Well, he did attend an MBSW party at Foley's in New York City, so he's down with the vibe.
He's down with the vibe for sure. On the break for me, by the way, I didn't get married. I went to Aruba, though, and everybody thought I was going to get married for some reason. Because, like, people evidently don't go to Aruba with their girlfriend without getting engaged, getting married. We went there. Very quickly, my favorite thing – listen, there's a lot of favorite things about Aruba. But my favorite weird, quirky thing about Aruba, we took a Jeep tour. One of the stops is something called Natural Bridge. They have one in Virginia, too. It's, a stone formation – that is, as it says, a natural bridge between two other landmasses. It's kind of a cool thing to see. We get there, we pull up in this bus, and we see this, like, bridge-type thing. It wasn't really all that grandiose and whatever. And the Aruban tour guide that we were with, who, by the way, was the Aruban Guy Fieri. If you could think of an Aruban Guy Fieri.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It was this guy. He stands up on a wall, and he says, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Natural Bridge. You may be looking around and saying to yourselves, where is the natural bridge? Well, it is one of Aruba's most famous tourist attractions. People love to come to see it. But at 4 o'clock in the morning in 1949, it fell into the ocean. But what we have is a backup bridge that people still come to see and walk over." It's the greatest thing ever.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's like going to see the St. Louis Arch, and it's not there, but the guy's like, "Oh, but we do have this inchworm that sometimes forms an arch with his back."
That's where it used to be. Our guest is standing by, good Greg Wyshynski, by the way.
Joining us now on the line, a man you may know as a MVSW party guest who evidently also dabbles in hockey management. It's Kyle Dubas, and he joins us now in the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast. Sir, congratulations on the new gig. And congratulations on becoming a lightning rod for the old guard to shoot their bolts at.
Thank you, but this is not the greatest accomplishment of the last year. That it's a distant second to attending the draft party, Merrick versus Wyshynski in New York, just 13 months ago.
Okay,
Merrick reminds me, by the way. Yes, please.
I gotta jump on something here, Kyle. My favorite moment at that, because I'm like, okay, my buddy Kyle is coming down. I've known Kyle for a long time, and Sheldon's coming, the head coach of the Greyhounds, and Richard's there, and so I come over and I introduce you to Greg, and Sheldon's there, and talking to all the guys and having a beer, and all of a sudden I introduce Greg to Joe Cirella, and regardless, like, hey, here's Kyle Dubas, young up and coming general manager, going to be a GM in the NHL one day, and here's Sheldon Keefe, an outstanding head coach of the Greyhounds, and he's going to make his way to the NHL as well. Greg turns to me and goes, "That's frickin' Joe Cirella. Joe Cirella's sitting here," because Wish is, of course, like the biggest New Jersey Devils fan. Like, the biggest pop of the entire night, with all due respect, Kyle, was when Greg got a chance to meet Joe Cirella.
It was great. Yeah. It was the most excited I've ever seen anybody, certainly anybody there that night. But Joe brought out the best in Greg, which was great.
It was basically like Merrick came over and said, "Oh, here's an actor by the name of Ryan Gosling, and here's his friend Carrot Top. Carrot Top!" And then I just...
That's the first time Joe Cirella's ever been compared to Carrot Top, for sure.
I was going to say, might want to go for something different. Hey, Greg mentioned sort of, becoming the lightning rod, or sort of the battleground for the old guard versus the new guard. How have you felt it now, just sort of a week into the gig?
I really haven't. I've been asked by a few people, and I haven't really had the chance to read a whole lot of what's been going on. The PR staff here and some people and some of my family and friends have kind of made mention of it, but I guess it's to be expected that it would kind of go that way. People trying to, I guess, determine whether I'm a hockey guy or an analytics guy, and then, I mean, the reality of it is that I'm someone who's worked in hockey my entire life that, over the past number of years has begun to develop, I guess, a usefulness for analytics that have really helped us in the Sioux over time. and especially in the last 18 months or so, as we've been able to gather more information. And it's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole secret sauce or anything like that. It helps out and has been a big help to us in reducing uncertainty and just gathering more information. But it's not a one way or the other type proposition with me or with us. It's just incorporating as much data and information we possibly can.
Did you get headhunted by the Leafs and Brendan Shanahan, or was it a position that you had to like apply for and stuff?
No, I was away in Mexico. My wife now, Shannon, and I got married there at the beginning of the month. And on the Friday night that we were there, I got an email. It was after our rehearsal dinner. We were walking back to our room, and my phone was off there, but it only got emails when Wi-Fi was available, and my phone started buzzing a bit, and I checked my emails, and there was one from Brendan saying that, you know, he had been talking to some people and talked to David Branch, and you know, just wanted to see if I had the chance to talk and get together at some point, and we got together when I got back from Mexico, and just kind of started to take off from there.
How did you meet Brian? I'm always curious about, you know, the associations and who brings who in, and maybe that's just an old school way of thinking, but what's the association between Kyle Dubas and Brendan Shanahan?
I met Brendan actually in New York when the NHL draft was that same, the infamous Merrick versus Wyshynski draft party.
Legendary now. Legendary, yeah. Isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And we met there briefly. Joe Sorrell actually introduced me to Brendan, and that was when he was still with the player safety department. That was just in passing and very briefly, and so I guess the connection, you know, as he said, was just from talking to people in hockey and from talking to people in our league that my name was one that was brought up to him that he wanted to meet and talk to. So I mean, I don't think it's a real traditional story of people knowing each other and playing together and working together or scouting together, anything like that. It just kind of one meeting, and it kind of took off from there.
Yeah, figures the one time Brendan Shanahan isn't at Foley's is the night we have the party. getting on the analytics thing, I mean, what areas of the game from that approach do you value? Like, are there certain metrics that you think are essential in your player evaluation? Are there some that you think are a little bit maybe overrated that people have kind of fallen in love with?
I think all of it. I think anything that happens on the ice, you can, if you can clearly explain it and have an idea of what you want to gather, you can find a way in the game of hockey. I know people will say in baseball it's different because everything is static. It starts, it stops, everything resets on every pitch, and so on and so forth. But in hockey, the game is so fluid. People are saying it's tough to gather different things, but you can kind of reach and track a bunch of different things that aren't really mainstream yet. And I think it all has value. It's just a matter of, you know, as we gather more data and go through more years, trying to find out, you know, which pieces of data can help us to eliminate uncertainty and which ones are, you know, maybe not what we thought they were, and trying to stay ahead of that curve. But it all adds to benefit personally for me anyway. It's all added to help when I get away from, you know, being able to track stuff and I'm going to scout players, whether that's, you know, at the minor midget level or junior A, junior B level when I was in Sault Ste. Marie. And I've just really found that it helps me when watching the game to identify subjectively things that we know objectively can help our team win hockey games.
How difficult is it, though? And I know you had people that know a guy by the name of Tyson Enfield, who does corporate sponsorships with the Greyhounds, handled a lot of the collecting of statistics and analyzing what happened on the ice, and that was shared amongst your group in the Sioux. But how difficult was it, specifically in junior, where the stats collection is pretty primitive, as you know, Kyle? How difficult is it not just to collect stats on your team, but if you're playing Kitchener, you're playing Sudbury, you're playing Guelph, how difficult is it to get sort of a league-wide snapshot of some of the comparative stats that you want/need?
In major junior, it's difficult, and you know, that's one of the things that you know, our staff in the Sioux said to me as well, is this past week, and while people are saying it's it would be tough for us with a numbers-based approach there. And that's what I mean. It wasn't really numbers-based. So people looking, like, we didn't make every decision by just taking the numbers, and nobody does that in hockey. Even those who are really strong analysts, you know, online or in print media, wherever it may be, they are all watching the game. So, I mean, they're not just sitting there at the computer and generating a list of this guy's good and this guy's bad, and this is what the numbers tell me. Everyone's watching the games, and I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions. But specific to Sault Ste. Marie, we were able to begin tracking everything that we were doing there. But when it came to identifying players on other teams in the league, we really had to be efficient. The first year, it was just me. And then the second year, we brought Tyson in. But in order for Tyson to be employed by our team, he had to also handle ticket sales. So we had Tyson, who was doing ticket sales full-time, and you know, he and I didn't have time to sit and build the whole thing. So Tyson worked to build a method to properly track without me sitting there just charting games myself and putting it in when I had time in the first year. But in the second year, Tyson developed that, and then we would have a method whereby if we were looking for other players in the league in that second year, we would begin to track them and try to identify players and other teams subjectively that were doing some of the things that we knew led to favorable outcomes.
Do you trust the numbers on sites like ExtraSkater, for example, that are sort of based on the numbers produced by NHL game reports? Like, I guess what I'm asking is, are there two sets of numbers, the internal data that NHL teams and junior teams compile themselves and the data that's available to fans that then kind of crunch their own numbers with? Is there a difference in those numbers, or is it all the same data?
I think there's definitely going to be a difference. There's going to be a difference in how two people watch the game. You and I sit and watch the game. Greg, you may think that a pass is a shot. I may think the alternative is true, and that's basically an event that's charted one way or the other, right? And so there's always going to be that level of subjectivity that goes into the numbers. But I mean, in the best way I think to track that is to take the game log and then, you know, just for clarity's sake, go back through it every so often, every X number of games, know if the score is different or if there's certain biases in certain scores, you can start to pick those up and begin to, you know, find out what the margin for error is or find out if there's a huge margin for error, because I think worse than having no information is having bad information and basing any sort of expertise off of that.
I just assume that if Joe Thornton has the puck, it's a pass. Well,
I guess I can't talk about him anymore. But he,
you're done now.
Yeah.
It's
former. Right,
yeah.
Sue Greyhound.
I was just gonna.
Sue Greyhound legend Joe Thornton. But
I was gonna say, is it considering tampering if you talk about like a player like Jared McCann signing with the Vancouver Canucks? And I guess it kind of is, Kyle. Hey,
that's
when did
Jeez.
When, it's weird, eh? It's a whole new reality talking to Kyle now. Hey, did you have like an aha moment with advanced analytics, or did something just sort of gradually sort of evolve into your lexicon, into how you watch games? Or was there one moment you said, hang on, there's something here?
I think it was just gradual over time, just reading some of the stuff that had been put up, you know, online and start to track and see whether there are any synergies between teams that perform well analytically and those teams that go on to have success. And I guess the first moments or number of moments where that, you know, where it kind of came up is when those, you know, there were certain predictions that were made about teams that analytics said were good teams. Maybe the standings didn't reflect that. And then really starting to get my head around the whole process of hockey. I mean, when I first came on to the Sioux, I certainly enjoyed reading about this stuff and had plans to incorporate it in, but I was still a big believer in, I guess you'd probably describe it as, you know, the things that my grandfather taught me that were important in hockey, even though a lot of the things that I learned from him were the things that we still use today and that are used to determine which teams are good in terms of possessing the puck, generating shots, so on and so forth, and the things that initiate the process that lead to those outcomes. But, you know, blocking shots, hits, they're things that I loved growing up in players and obviously still do to an extent at certain times, but being able to see the correlation brought out between players that, you know, lead the league and or teams that lead the league in those statistics and where they fit in the end in the standings. So that was probably one of the key moments for me later during my time at Uptown Sports, and just kind of went from there.
Yeah, Uptown Sports, then obviously the GM gig with the Sioux. I mean, I feel like we're making you out to be Billy Beane here or something, like, you know, you're just a numbers guy. But, I mean, there's so much more to your experience beyond just the analytics thing. I mean, you put your balls on the line in hiring Keith as your coach. And there was another thing I actually wanted to bring up with you, because I feel like it's sort of quasi in the news now with all this Ray Rice stuff, which was the Nick Cousins thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a situation that a lot of people, I'm sure, on both sides of the equation. Like I remember reading a quote from you that said there is no right answer. One group is going to be pissed off no matter how you handle the situation. They, you know, wound up not being charged or prosecuted, I should say, for the sexual assault stuff, but they went to treatment for 2 weeks. They missed camp. They missed 3 out of 4 exhibition games. Looking back on it, are you content with the way that you handled things with that?
You know, it's, you know, I don't know that there's there's so many moving parts to that. And there's no way to talk about it that doesn't come off as insensitive. That's what I've learned. It's, mm-hmm. some party to the whole situation is upset, rightfully so. When things of that nature happen, and it obviously happened in Sault Ste. Marie, you know, what's presented as being from me is everything goes through the team's legal department and the team, and the decision making is, you know, you're involved and you sit in, you give your opinion, but it goes to the ownership level and the legal department, and, you know, you're caught in the crosshairs between, you know, obviously publicly what people think is the right thing to do, what you know privately about the situation and what happened, and, you know, then there's the legal side of it where, you know, the lawyer says, well, you know, and the players' agents and so on are saying, well, you can't come down on these guys because they're owed their day in court if that happens, and so on and so forth. It's extremely difficult, and whenever players that you're that are on your club, the most difficult thing that we've ever dealt with, and I don't think yeah. In those situations, no matter what you do, there's going to be people that say you didn't handle it well, and we tried to do what was best, and in my case it was, you're representing the team and being guided by the legal experts of the team, and you know that's the way it went there with that situation, but it's not something that I'm proud of or that, you know, obviously I hope to ever go through again. I mean, I have 4 younger sisters, and, you know, after that time, after that incident, it was, you know, people were, you know, would make comments to me about that. You know, what if it was your sister involved? And it's not something I ever want to experience or go through again, getting a call at 4 o'clock in the morning for an incident of that severity and that serious. Was not good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Business today with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Curious how involved, if at all, because this is still a new gig for you. The Daniel Winnick signing, 1 year with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Was that something that you had a hand in, you were a consultant on? And if so, make the case why Daniel Winnick should be a Maple Leaf.
That was a player that Brendan and Dave had liked, and we discussed here internally, and just tried to carve out a way that he could how he would help and benefit the Toronto Maple Leafs next season, and you know, he's available now, and we felt could be a big help. He's got a good track record of soaking up some difficult minutes, and even, you know, being able to really play well with some younger players. I'm going back to his Colorado days when he played a lot of minutes with guys like O'Reilly and Landeskog, and had success. And, you know, with the direction that the team is going under Brendan and Dave, I think he can be a real good help to us this season. So definitely excited for guys like him and David Booth and James Reimer and Cody Franzen, who've all re-signed here in the last week. Excited to see them in a month or month and a half when we get rolling here.
Being joined by Kyle Dubas, he is the assistant general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and I think Wish's line may have dropped. So it's just you and me, Kyle, for the we'll land this thing. When you look back at your time at the Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds, and by the way, you leave as they're poised for like immense success this year in the OHL. You have like I think 12 or 13 returning players, like a stacked team. I was talking to some OHL kids at the gym today, and they're all like Sue Greyhounds and the Kingston Frontenacs are going to be sick this year. But when you look back at your time in the Sioux, what are you most proud of?
So far, I mean, certainly I think watching Sheldon develop as a coach and evolve as a coach, and you know, that's been a lot of fun for me. And I think, you know, looking at guys like Darnell Nurse and Patrick Watling who've won academic awards, and seeing, you know, more importantly, I think guys that we call, they're converting from being major junior players to pros by signing NHL deals. We had a real good run last year where six guys signed in 6 months, and we had 14 players drafted to the NHL over that time, and that's been seeing that the program continue to take off and so on. That was that's been the most fun for me. So it's been I'm excited to watch it continue to progress, and they've got some great people there. It was a wonderful place to work, and I'm looking forward to continuing to watch as a fan, and I know that great things are in store there with Sheldon and the entire staff. So
last one for me, Kyle. We talked about it briefly. You can't be Kyle anymore, man. You got to be all buttoned up and watching out who you talk about now. Your Twitter feed by far is one of my favorite things, because like it's legit all over the place, really good information, stuff on other sports. Can you still be a social media gadfly whilst working for the Toronto Maple Leafs as an assistant GM?
I'm just going to be myself. And if, I don't ever want to change the way that I am. I enjoy the social media aspect of it. I think in the Sioux, especially during the first year and a half when things weren't going great, it was a way for us to connect with fans and sort of keep them on board. But I learn a lot on social media. There's a lot of very interesting people in hockey hockey isn't everything in life, obviously, but lots of other interesting information that comes up on there that you learn from, and just reading the discussion that goes on sometimes between people where they're arguing even, what you can learn from seeing that sort of stuff, I find it to be really interesting. I don't envision it changing. I envision it me just continuing on as myself, and that's that. I don't really want to change, and I won't, I guess.
Hey, listen, Kyle, last question from this microphone, and congratulations and best of luck from all of us here, both at this side of the microphone and everyone listening as well. How many members of your family now have had to burn Detroit Red Wings jerseys since you took the job?
Ridiculous amount. That's probably one of my worst mistakes growing up, was I had a family full of Red Wing fans, and me wanting to be different, when the Ottawa Senators came in, I jumped to the Sens, which led to a lot of heartbreak right here at the Air Canada Center later on in my teenage and university days. But that's okay. But I got off the Red Wings bus in about 92, 93, and then missed out on three Stanley Cups.
Yeah.
So not very good decision making by me there. But that's okay. so. But now I get to see them all make the transition over to, I think it's safe to say, in my family, the hated Leafs. And it's amazing how fast they've become fans. It's great.
And just to clarify, did you convert your dog's fandom recently? Did I see that?
That was the doing of my wife. But I think he's a loyal. I think he'll be split between the Greyhounds and the Leafs. Murray, he's a loyal guy. I can't. He didn't look all too thrilled in the photo, as you can see. He wasn't in his familiar Sioux Greyhounds garb. So he'll be okay.
That's awesome. Listen, Kyle, I know you got a lot of heavy lifting to do, both in Toronto and still some business to take care of in the Sioux. We wish you all the best, and good luck with the new gig. We'll talk soon.
Thank you very much, guys.
Take care.
Assistant GM of the Maple Leafs and the man that told me why Kyle Clifford's nickname is the Colonel.
Why is it the Colonel?
Because his middle name is Frank.
Wow. Is that a MASH reference?
What's that?
What was
no.
it?
No,
what
his
is
middle
it?
Name his middle name is Frank, so they call him the Colonel. It's when he was used to be with Uptown. We were texting one night. I was on hockey, and he says, "Hey man, Colonel's doing great tonight." So I was pumping the clients, right? Yeah. I'm like, "Colonel." He goes, "Yeah, Clifford." I go, "Why do you call him the Colonel?" He goes, "His middle name is Frank. Think about it." And I thought about it, and dummy me
KFC.
Doesn't get it.
Oh,
KFC.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, thanks man.
That's pretty good.
Kyle. Yeah,
nice. He's great, man. And like you know, it. Here's the thing about the hiring. I wrote about this over the weekend, and I relate it to myself in some ways, but by no means did we have the same kind of path professionally. I actually think that he's in some ways way more qualified than I was when I ascended the ladder of journalism. But there's always people in every profession that are going to try to knock you down because your age. It's like reverse ageism, I guess.
Of course.
And they're going to knock you down because you didn't take the approved path to your achievement in that profession that they believe you should have taken. And in Kyle's case, he certainly didn't have a traditional path to that job. And I think there's a lot of people that bemoan that. Where's your scouting? Where's your time paying your dues?
Actually, hang on. Whiz
kid youngin.
When you want to talk about scouting, that is one of the guys of any general manager in the OHL that you saw at minor midget rinks more than anybody else. I can't tell you how many times I would call Kyle and he would be at some outpost because he wanted to watch two periods of some kid play. Like he was like,
but he's the classic,
not in Sault Ste. Marie a ton.
Right, exactly, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
It isn't with every GM, but it should be that way. But he's got a non-traditional way of going about things with the analytics. He's young. He wasn't, in my case, it was, you were never an intern at the Washington Post. And in his case, it was, you never did XYZ like every other guy. The bottom line is that he's a breath of fresh air for a couple of reasons. These were things that were touched on by the Boston Globe over the weekend. He's a breath of fresh air because he didn't have a traditional path. He's a breath of fresh air because he is young. And he's not simply a retread. He's a breath of fresh air because it's not about who you knew in this situation. Okay, he knew Joe Cirelli, who knew Brendan Shanahan. That's not the same thing as calling up your old teammate and being like, I need a gig, and then getting the job. Or calling up your old team and being like, I'm getting into management now. And they're like, why? That's amazing. You're a player with name recognition, and we can use you for good public relations if we put you on the payroll. There's nothing like that. It was a guy getting this job based on his own merits, and that's an important thing. And it's an important thing also that he's a non-traditional candidate because, as the Globe pointed out, there is a very big problem in management in the National Hockey League and in every rank of hockey professionally in North America. It's a color problem and it's a gender problem. And maybe if they start thinking outside the box on a number of these different things, maybe we can correct some of those problems. And the last thing I'll say about this hiring is about Brendan Shanahan, who, you know, I covered pretty closely during his Department of Player Safety days, spoke with him on a number of occasions. One of the things I always thought he brought to the table in this role as the grand poobah of Maple Leaf sports is that he's a good coalition builder, and he's a good guy at building brain trusts. You look at that Department of Player Safety situation over there, he managed to get some really smart old-school guys, and say what you will about Colin Campbell, but he's a very smart old-school guy,
yes,
and guys like Damian Echeverria behind the scenes, who was a very, very big influence on the Department of Player Safety video explanations and stuff like that, bringing in Patrick Burke, bringing all these people together and putting them under the same tent and having them work on ways to go about this thing in a different manner. And in my mind, I know we can all quibble about the length of suspensions and things like that, but overall, from an operational standpoint, the Department of Player Safety was an enormous success under Brendan Shanahan, and you're starting to see the same blocks being built now with the Leafs, which is who can we bring in that's not been in the conversation that can join the conversation and make things better here?
And there are, it's a couple of swing for the fences moves as well. Now, the Maple Leafs aren't the first team or, by any stretch of the imagination, the only team to have someone under the roof who uses sophisticated analytics to analyze the game and then shares that with the general manager and team president. It happens, right? There are plenty of teams that do this right now. This is a very significant hiring because, A, it's a Toronto Maple Leafs, so if it moves an inch to the left or an inch to the right, it's going to be a headline and probably for a long time. But also, it's a power position. Say what you want about assistant general manager. You know, that's a stone's throw away from the GM's door. So now you are inching closer. And to me, in a lot of ways, it's a home run swing, not unlike what they did at the draft, taking Willie Nylander, who is a home run swing. I think that Nylander is going to be an excellent player. Now, if you watch the U18 tournament this year, you think the guy's going to be a star because essentially he's a two-point-a-guy game who dominated, played over everyone else's heads. But there's still no guarantees that Willie Nylander is going to be a bona fide superstar in the NHL. He may just be a fringe guy. Who knows? But the potential is there. And that's what I like about Shanahan in this situation here with Kyle Dubas and drafting Willie Nylander, two pretty significant moves in the Shanahan regime. They're swings for the fences. It's like, if you're going to win, win with a tape measure home run. You know, you're not going to bunt and walk your way to the World Series title. Let's get some long balls going here.
And not small ball, long ball.
Long ball, that's right. Long ball, baby. That's what I like about it. And listen, I'm biased completely because I've known Kyle for so long and have, you know, admired his work with Uptown and certainly with the Greyhounds and now into professional hockey with the Toronto Maple Leafs. But he does represent a breath of fresh air. He is something that sort of – what it does, the Dubas hiring kind of reminds you just how conservative and in a lot of ways, you know, small-minded hockey is. It is a game that sort of evolves inch by inch by inch. It is very – if you introduce anything new, and I'll go at you with a shootout on this one, Wish, people lose their mind. That's why the shootout was such a freak, because even progressive thinkers like Greg Wyshynski lost their mind about it. Someone who is like, yeah, this tradition is bogus, and I like this, and move it forward, and let's move the goal. Even you were like, I can't believe it. It really does underscore how conservative a sport hockey is. It has been weighed down by tradition. Like, I always think to myself, I think I mentioned this on the podcast before, what would hockey be if it started right now? Like, if you started hockey right now at this moment, would it look anything like we see today, Greg? I would submit no.
In fairness, I am a very progressive thinker on all fronts.
That's what I said.
But just because let me put this in context. Just because I'm in favor of the legalization of marijuana and I'm in favor of same-sex marriage doesn't mean I think we should allow people to marry bags of angel dust. You know what I'm saying? You gotta draw a line somewhere.
Hey man, we all make our choices. I've made mine. Some wise, some poor. I stand by them.
Unless, of course, you can marry that bag of angel dust in 10 minutes. I mean, which you know is something you could evidently do in Toronto.
Right.
It was pretty good.
Yeah, that's right. Going down Toronto.
All right, moving on to – we got a lot of stuff to cover we were off for a little bit. I want to touch on the NBC schedule. So every year NBC here in the States releases their television schedule, and every year on Puck Daddy we count the number of appearances by teams on that schedule. It's always a very enlightening thing, not only about the teams that these executives feel are going to be the most compelling in the next season, but also it's a reminder of which markets actually drive the bus ratings-wise for the NHL. And that's kind of the frustrating part about it, to be honest with you, is that the NHL, for all of its gains, and the fact of the matter is that we have over a dozen teams that, to me, are marketable teams to American audiences. You say the name and they're like, I'm going to make time to watch that team because I know that team. I know the players and I've seen them challenge for the cup and they're an exciting team and I'm going to do this. They've been in the Winter Classic. You also have this problem where you can't throw any team Team X, let's say, on TV, and it's going to get ratings. I think the NBA can do that, and I think the NFL can certainly do that. But the NHL is not there yet. And we see that in the fact that the Buffalo Sabres, as previously mentioned, have 11 appearances on NBC Sports Network and NBC next season. That's atrocious. They're a team that's going to be terrible. They're a team that's going to be losing on purpose to gain a high draft pick. They're going to be on television 11 times because Buffalo still drives the ratings bus.
Pumps the number.
They just do.
Absolutely.
They always do. They pump the number. There are a number of teams that have five or fewer games.
Hang on, one thing. Let me just comment. Because I'm of two minds on it because I live in two worlds. I live in the world of television and I live in the world of a hockey fan. And the hockey fan in me can't stand that, but the television guy understands that completely. And I've sat in those boardrooms and talked to those people about making decisions. Listen, I was at CBC for 4 years and always a decision to defer to a Maple Leafs game nationally at 7 o'clock, even though they're like 15 games out of a playoff spot. You know, that would always be met by, derision across the country. Somehow I ended up taking the brunt of it on Twitter for some reason, like it was my decision. But I understand that. Like, I understand the decision because those TV executives are interested in one thing and one thing only, not building new stars and putting on the best possible match. No. What is going to deliver the most eyeballs, period?
My counterargument has always been that I think it benefits the network in the long run if they put these teams on. These very good teams that commit the sin of being Canadian or commit the sin of being small market and not – amongst the original six or teams that appear in the Winter Classic on the reg, I think it helps them, it benefits them to put these teams on now because more people will see them and more people will want to watch them when the playoffs roll around. And I think Montreal is a great example of that. We brought that up with PK Subban before. The idea that the Canadiens made a playoff run last year and yet are only on television twice on NBC Sports Network is insane to me. They have marketable players. They've got great young players, Subban, Galchenyuk, on and on, Carey Price between the pipes. It's a very compelling team, and you can throw that team into a number of different matchups with Eastern Conference teams, be it the Boston Bruins, be it the Rangers, whoever, and I think you're going to get people to watch without question. So I don't quite understand that. Here are the teams that are on five or fewer times. The Coyotes once, Calgary none, Edmonton none, Vancouver none. The Dallas Stars four times. We'll get back to them in a second. Nashville Predators one, Jets nothing, Florida nothing, Habs twice, Senators nothing, Tampa Bay five times, the Leafs twice, the Hurricanes three times, the Blue Jackets one time. We'll get to them in a second. The Devils twice, and the Islanders no times. How on earth do you have the New York Islanders without a game? John Tavares without a game? A team in a New York market without a game? How does that happen?
Did they not
How
move
do you not
the needle
get
at all?
One Hang Devil's on, Rangers?
Islanders
Devil. Like, how do you not have? Okay, so that's one problem. Listen, I don't profess to be a television executive. Okay, I don't know how these things work. But if the Columbus – how do the Columbus Blue Jackets have one appearance? You're going to tell me that in six games against the Penguins, they didn't create some fans? They didn't create some buzz? They didn't create some interest in that franchise? People who watch that series wouldn't tune in next season to see a bunch of kids hauling ass against the Penguins or the Flyers or the Bruins? Seriously?
Who is – okay, let me go back this way. Okay, who are you marketing? If you're going to focus on one guy, like if you're going to focus on like Pat Kane and the Chicago Blackhawks come to Detroit to face off against Pavel Datsyuk and the Detroit Red Wings, who's your guy for Columbus?
Well, in theory, it would be Johansson, but he's not there yet.
Not even signed yet.
No, he's not. Johansson's not signed yet. Dubinsky, Jack Johnson.
Those move a needle?
Well, they don't move a needle, but again, like, I don't think individuals necessarily move a needle in the States. I think teams
I'm saying, think like an executive here. Where's the sexy?
Okay, but hold on. If you're going to say
come where's see
the
Matt
sexy,
Calvert. Come right, see fine, Matt but, Calvert, but stay for Dalton Prout.
But if you're going to say where's the sexy, then how do you possibly have the Lightning on only five times?
That I disagree with.
Yeah.
That I disagree with. Okay, now we're finding common ground. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the Dallas Stars, the Dallas Stars, the other one. Like, I understand that there's a certain West Coast bias going on here, and I understand because of time differences, whatever, you can't necessarily get Dallas on all the time. But I'm sorry, like, Tyler Seguin and Jamie Benn and the additions that they've made on that team, Spezza, like, how four times for a team that created more offseason buzz than three quarters of the league?
Yep. And they're going to be damn good this year, too.
Insane. So we always find ways to nitpick this thing. But, you know, all I'm saying is that maybe a take one or two of the 19 times the Penguins are on NBC next year and kick it over to Dallas or kick one over to Columbus. Wouldn't that be nice?
Think like an executive. They think that one personality pops it. That's why Sidney's always going to be on a ton. Penguins are always going to be on a ton. Anywhere Ovechkin goes.
Ovi's on 13 times, by the way. The top ones are for NBC. The Chicago Blackhawks are on 20 times, completely understandable. The Penguins are on 19. The Flyers are on 16. The Bruins are on 17. The Flyers are on 16. The Red Wings are on 15, and the Rangers are on 14. Those are your leaders, and the Caps are on 13.
Which of those teams do you think will struggle the most this year? And if you say anyone other than Philadelphia, I'm hanging up.
Well, this would be a handy way to end the show on time.
No, I think you're right. The phone hasn't buzzed out on me before.
Thank you. It'd
be a challenging one. But those are big, sexy teams and sexy markets with sexy stars.
That's
the way executives think.
We asked you guys to write in with some stuff, some topics that we didn't get to address during the vacation, and we're going to hit some of them before the end of the show today. One that we should probably talk about because it's one that got a lot of buzz from people was...
What's up?
So Steven Stamkos, a favorite to tweet, that talked about him going to Toronto, and then he was in Toronto at an event and was asked about it. He did nothing to say that he will never play in Toronto. He did nothing to say that he will play as the rest of his career in Tampa Bay, and thus began some summer conversation about Steven Stamkos potentially playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs when his contract in Tampa Bay is up. Do you think that Steven Stamkos will be the exception to the rule and become the one superstar who comes home to play with Toronto? Do you believe, Jeff Merrick, that he will be Leaf Braun?
If, put it this way, if Tim Leiwicki is still there, and that is no guarantee, which may be a controversial thing to say, but if Tim Leiwicki is still there,
hot takes.
That is a very Leiwicki-esque play. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't surprise me if Stamkos is the kid that goes home. Sorry to all Tampa Bay Lightning fans. And listen, he may just renew a top dollar and they hang on to him and that's the end of that. And it's, you know, crush every other, you know, a local boy comes home story for Toronto that Maple Leafs fans have wanted for, going back, you know, eons. But if anyone's going to do it, it wouldn't surprise me if it's Stamkos.
Yeah, I kind of feel like he's the guy that wouldn't shy away from it. But like I said in the piece that I wrote about this when the whole thing was bubbling up, like it would become exponentially easier for him to make that decision if he did what LeBron did, which is win. I mean, the only reason LeBron's in Cleveland is because he won. I don't think he'd be in Cleveland. I think he'd be looking for the next trio of superstars he could combine his powers with to win a championship had he not won in Miami. And I think it's the same thing with Stamkos. Like, I think if this John Cooper team, which is going to be pretty damn good for the next 2 years, can find a way to win the cup with Stamkos, then I think the runway is clear. Then I think he goes to Toronto without a second question asked because he's already won. I think the nightmare scenario for Steven Stamkos is going to Toronto with the expectation of being the guy who's going to break the Schneid there, but never having won before that. I think it becomes a lot easier to make that move if you have a ring already.
Do you think it really matters, though?
I do.
Yeah, so you would draw a direct association then with LeBron? Like you're comfortable with that? Like, man, if he wins in Tampa, then yeah, maybe he'll look for a new challenge or he'll be like, oh, I got my Stanley Cup and just going to go have some fun and play for my favorite hockey team growing up.
I think it's one set of pressures to win a cup. It's another set of pressures to be the Messiah, which is what he would have to be in Toronto. You know what I mean? It's like if you won before, it's no different than Messier. Like Messier going to New York, had he never won before, is a completely different situation than going there as capital letters Mark Messier.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think there are a couple. I mean, if things don't turn around on Long Island, I'm not so sure that if I'm John Tavares, I want to hang around much longer, although I think there will be a I always go back and forth with various people. I don't know how much improved they're going to be this year, but they should be better. Garcinot better. Hope they could be better, or else he's just traded Jack Eichel or Connor McDavid. Like, if the Islanders really fizzle again, could John Tavares be the guy before Steven Stamkos to go to Toronto?
Whoa.
Not obviously waiting for free agency, but, hey, get my agent on the line. I want out of here.
The race is on. The race is on. Of course, maybe they could become the Taves and Kane of Toronto.
Might.
The cap. If the cap is $200 million in a few years, I think they'll be able to sign both Tavares and Stamkos.
Yeah, maybe. I wonder if there is, like, and I think the Islanders will be better next year, but I wonder if there is someone who sort of acts as a Pied Piper. Like, eventually all teams have that. I've had enough with their superstars if things just don't improve. Maybe it's John Tavares. Maybe it's Kyle Okposo. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Chris Bush writes in, was hoping to hear about Nashville's Center Seinfest 2014 with Jokinen, Ribeiro, and Wah. Sorry, Wah. Jesus Christ. Roy. Thank you. The latter two. Without seeing Derek in front of that, I automatically go to Wah because Patrick has got me hardwired for that. And Roy, the latter two happening while on the break. Yeah, it's true. Ribeiro and Roy did happen while you were on the break. In Ribeiro's case, yeah. You know, you get the feeling that David Poile runs a pretty tight ship there, not only because of the way the Radulov stuff went down, and not only because they have guys like Mike Fisher in that room, but because you just get the sense that's how Poile is. And so the Ribeiro signing was one that struck me as being interesting, almost in the sense of a guy going to rehab. Like, he's going off to some place where he can get his shit in order, and that's kind of how it feels with Ribeiro. It's a great signing for the price and the term.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, and if it was, in fact, a situation where his marital woes were the reason why things fell apart in Phoenix or Glendale or Arizona, whatever we're going with this week, then I think that it makes sense that if he can put that behind him, then he can thrive there. And, hey, listen, you had a problem on your hands in Nashville. You had a star winger in James Neal that you acquired who went from playing with Evgeny Malkin and Sidney Crosby in Pittsburgh to playing with nobody in Nashville after Mike Fisher got hurt. Yeah. So this move gives him not only a center that can be a playmaker who was a point-per-game player in Washington just a scant 2 years ago in the lockout season, but also gives him a player he's played with before. It was a really smart, shrewd move by Poile. I liked it a lot.
This is all on the heels of striking out on Jason Spezza and then Mike Fisher going down. I just don't know, like, when you look at this, like, when you look at how the West is won, isn't it kind of down the middle? And I don't know that if I'm Nashville and I'm coming with Jokinen, Ribeiro, Derek, Roy, thank you, and Paul Gostad, yeah, you're going to win that battle in the West. But you needed some sentiment. Here's my question. Who do you think they play with James Neal?
Gotta be Ribeiro, right? No?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Or do they play Oli? Hang on, is Oli Jokinen now a first line center again in the NHL?
Oh, God.
I'm serious. Like, okay, hang on. It's like, okay, so you have, okay, who would you do here? You do James Neal, Oli Jokinen, and Gabriel Bork, or Matt Cullen on your first line left. Ribeiro, either Bork, Cullen, and Craig Smith, or Colin Wilson as your second line. I don't know. Like, who are you more comfortable with you know, playing alongside Oli Jokinen or Mike Ribeiro? It'll take a few games probably to sort itself out, and Peter Laviolette that will have to make that decision. But this is an interesting one. Who do you put on the right side of Jokinen? Who do you put on the right side of Mike Ribeiro?
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Bobo Knudsen writes in, while the Johansson signing is still looming and needs to be taken care of before the start of the season, it is the Brandon Dubinsky signing that seems to be noteworthy. There's a bunch of stuff about Dubinsky there. I would suggest this is a strong vote of confidence in the direction of the organization under JD and Yarmo. As a transplanted Canadian, I have found Columbus and the Dublin area. Ooh, I was in Dublin, Ohio on St. Patrick's Day, no less. A fantastic place to live and definitely welcome both you and Jeff to come to the NHL All-Star Game. Well, I'll be there. I assume Merrick will be there too.
So.
Yeah, the Dubinsky signing was great and an important signing for that team and a guy who I think really showed his value in that little mini postseason run they had against the Penguins. Shutting down an admittedly injured Sidney Crosby, but still. I mean, just playing extraordinarily well.
Listen, man, if that's like your next burgeoning enemy publicly, like if that's like the next big feud in the Eastern Conference, Columbus and Pittsburgh, man, you got to have Brandon Dubinsky on your team because he drives Sidney Crosby nuts to no end. I think it's a wonderful signing. If for the other reasons that Dubinsky comes along with it, certainly, but the Crosby factor is huge because he drives Crosby nuts.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of things have been driving Sidney Crosby nuts in the past few years, and it's probably a situation where someone in the organization needs to say, just focus on playing hockey.
Yeah.
Like, enough with the beacon, enough with the – just Sidney, you know, you're one of, if not the greatest player in the world. Just play hockey because you're really good at it. But Dubinsky drives him nuts.
Dude, yeah, just kick back, play hockey, look around that roster, understand how amazingly – deep and plentiful. They're paper thin. I just remember.
Completely. How dare thin. You? How dare you disparage Bo Bennett like that?
Okay.
What do you say about Nick Spaulding? Come on.
Finally, I wanted to shy away from kind of going postal type questions because we have that. We're going to do a show Wednesday, by the way. We know that for certain. We're not sure about the rest of the week, but definitely Wednesday we'll be back. To do another program for your entertainment and downloading and all that stuff. But Andrew Bain writes in with a very important question and, of course, allows me to do the Bain voice.
Here it comes.
Question of the day. Beer consumption over the break? What did you drink? Like? Not like? And how much?
Beer consumption over the break. Well, so there's a beer in Aruba. Every island has their own beer, basically, right? And I had the Pitons. I think it was actually called Piton in Saint Lucia. Aruba has a beer called Balashi. That's their beer. And here's the thing you need to know about all of these island beers. They all taste like Heineken. But shitty Heineken, because everybody basically was founded by the Dutch, right? So it all tastes like shitty Heineken.
Can I ask a question about Heineken?
Yeah.
And I'm obviously not your. I'm not asking you specifically, but people that are listening overseas, our friends in Europe, is Heineken kind of the Budweiser of Europe? Is that kind of what it's considered?
See, I thought you were gonna. Say, can I ask you a question about Heineken? Ask me a question about shitty Heineken. Is it redundant what you just said? No, I kind of don't mind Heineken in certain settings, but like the weird tasting, not Heineken that populates all of the islands and becomes their official beer. It's just not palatable.
Tastes like Heineken.
That said, and this is the great thing that I found in Aruba. If you don't want to drink the shitty Heineken, aka Balashi. The brewery also makes a shitty Corona called Chill. And so I had a lot of Chill. Buckets of Chill. Not so much Balashi, but I had buckets of Chill in Aruba. So that was really tasty. And, of course, the other thing, too, on vacation was you're not there to drink the beer. You're there to drink the rum. And Ruby and I stayed at a Marriott resort, which was very nice. It was a cool place. Lost large on craps, then won it all back the other night, another night. And that was actually at the Ritz-Carlton next door.
Let me
get into that in 1 second.
All right.
The Marriott was cool, but what you end up doing is you end up buying all these rum drinks and then charging it to your room, and then you realize how deep you are in the hole, even if you're buying rum at happy hour. Here's the thing about craps. This is a life-affirming moment that I had in Aruba. Craps is a game I love to play. I'm not all that good at it. I'm not all that lucky at it, but it's a game where you can bet smart and stay there for a long time. And unless you are effing with the dice, almost impossible for the casino to fix the game. I am an extraordinarily wary gambler and suspicious gambler when it comes to gambling outside of regulated places like Las Vegas and Atlantic City. I have gotten my ass kicked on boats. I've gotten my ass kicked at island casinos, and I sat down for about 10 hands of blackjack and lost all 10 with the dealer doing the dealer was pulling aces after everyone at the table had gotten an ace. Like, it, statistically impossible things were happening. I asked my tour guide about it, the one who took us to the natural bridge that got knocked down. I'm like, can I ask you something? Why doesn't the Marriott have craps? Because the Marriott didn't have craps. We had to go next door to the Ritz-Carlton and play craps because they didn't have craps in the Marriott. I'm like, he's like, you know, some rooms on this island, they simply don't have the dice games. I'm like, I got a theory. I think they're able to fix everything. The slots, the blackjack, the whatever, all the card games. But they can't fix craps. So they don't have it. Kind of like... got quiet for a second, and the Reuben Guy Fieri then like raised his glasses and looked me in the eye, and he said, "That's the secret, man." He goes, "When you sit down at the blackjack table and you start winning a hand or two, and then they swap out the pretty young girl and bring in the old man, walk away. Walk away, because the game is about to change."
That's a great line.
That's the best.
Skull life affirming.
Did you drink anything interesting during your couple weeks, sir?
No, not at my beer intake is embarrassingly low. Well, to begin with, and now it's even worse this summer. I'm actually in a pretty good sort of groove in my life for between like working out, running, and yoga, and all that kind of stuff. Mind you, I've had a couple of glasses of wine here and there. But no, nothing exceptional. I've treated sort of this break as a chance to catch up on sleep and really get healthy. Surprise, surprise.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And real I'm sober,
I'm sober now. What the hell's up with that? What the hell's up with that?
Yeah, I know. It's a there should be a day where we had the drunk podcast start yelling at each other. Sure. Real quick, at the end of the program today, wanted to also, because people always ask, like, what'd you listen to? What'd you read and stuff? I did read a couple books over the break. I didn't read anything hockey, although I do have a review copy of a Jordan Tutu book that Stephen Brunt co-wrote.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm gonna read that thing quick. That's funny, knocking at my door. They can come back.
Answered on
No, I can't do it. So I read Song of the Spider-Man. Okay, Song of the Spider-Man, which was the book written about the Spider-Man musical, Turn Off the Dark. Which
was the one where the guy died?
He didn't die. He just like broke his back.
Oh, okay.
Oh, music by U2, directed by Julie Taymor, an epic fail of a musical, and it was an interesting look back at the creative process and what went wrong and how things went off the rails and how they actually wound up making a musical that wound up being a financial success, but they were so deep in the hole there was no way to sustain it. Really good book there. And keeping with the theme of disasters, I also read what the hell is the name of the book? The Disaster Artist. The Disaster Artist is written by one of the co-stars of The Room being one of the worst movies ever made, and it's all about the production of the film and the megalomaniacal leadership of one Tommy Wiseau as the director and star. And if you've seen The Room, the Song of the Spider-Man thing kind of got kind of dry here and there. It was a good story, but not very propulsive. This one was damn good. And if you've ever seen The Room and you understand how Tommy Wiseau speaks, it's almost like my Bobby Holdeck impression. Read this book. There's a lot of like quotes from him in the book, and it becomes this amazing. I can't compare it to anything, but it was almost like a book in which you're seeing the artistic process play out by a complete delusional maniac. It was very much like I imagine someone. It's called The Disaster Artist, and I imagine if anybody ever appeared on an Ed Wood movie and then wrote the quintessential Ed Wood book, it would be like that too. It's great. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's just.
Did you read anything? You read any hockey stuff during the break?
I finished a review copy for Ken Reed's book. Ken, my buddy who works at Sportsnet, wrote this really cool book just based on his favorite hockey cards. And has interviews with a lot of people about the cards and about their careers. And we're going to get Kenny on when the book is actually officially released. A book on the history of the rules evolution that I was telling you about. But kind of in the summer, I don't read a whole ton of hockey books. Like during the year, I'm kind of in complete hockey mode. So I read, you know, I'm always reading blogs and books and watching videos. And so that's like hardcore hockey time for like 8-10 months. And summer I kind of do other things, like, I don't know what I've been reading a lot of Alan Watts this year, and watching some pretty sweet documentaries. I live on a website called documentaryheaven.com. You're familiar with that site? Documentaryheaven. Oh, dude, it's your best friend. If you're a fan of documentaries, as am I, the latest one that I'm about halfway through right now is called The Day After Trinity, which is about Robert Oppenheimer and the development of the nuclear bomb. Man. Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And then just listening to, like, Dan Carlin podcasts and my new favorites, which is, I don't know if you've heard it yet, but if you haven't, go listen to the one with Jeffrey Ross for the obvious reasons, Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast.
Oh, no. You asked me about that. I have
it's
not.
So
oh,
good,
and
dude.
I will recommend for anybody who's old enough to remember this guy. I highly recommend this podcast too. So I kind of run hot and cold on WTF with Mark Maron. I usually now just listen depending on the guest. He had on, and I don't know if you know this comedian or not. Are you familiar with the comedian The Amazing Jonathan?
No.
The Amazing Jonathan was what came up in that era of sort of like Penn and Teller, Joel Hodgson, prop comic slash magicians, Harry Anderson being another one from the guy who was in Night Court. And so The Amazing Jonathan, the show itself was an amazing look back at an era in stand-up comedy that doesn't get a lot of attention. He also hosted a very short-lived game show that originated from Merv Griffin's casino in Atlantic City that was on NBC, and basically admitted that they used to fix the games on the game show, and they didn't realize it was against the law to do so, which is amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
But he's done so many drugs. He has some ailment now where the doctors say he could die at any point. Like at any moment,
what?
He could just drop dead.
From
and
doing
he did the
drugs.
This was a revelation. I don't, all, everything. He talks about the whole thing on the show. And in the first 10 minutes of the podcast, he's like, oh, by the way, I have this thing and I could die at any moment. And wouldn't it be amazing if I just dropped it right on this podcast?
You know what?
I won't tell if he does or doesn't.
It's got like a Howard Beale Network kind of vibe around it. Tomorrow I'm going to kill myself on the air.
Yeah, it was a really intense.
So hang on.
Podcast,
dying from doing too many drugs?
I think, yeah. His body was ravaged.
Really, eh? Oof.
Yeah, the Amazing Jonathan podcast in WTF is one that I listened to on the plane, and it was really great. There it is. All right, listen. It's enough of this non-hockey malarkey. We'll pick up with the hockey talk on Wednesday, whatever hockey talk there
you're
is.
Like, drugs don't really kill you, though, right? Like, I've kind of done a few on my life.
No, not at all.
All good?
Not at all. Why would you even
think
about it?
Sure. Just making sure. All right. They're good for you, right? Like they're little health candies, right?
Yeah, I mean, it puts your mind in the right place. Hey, if it's good enough for an NFL place kicker, it's good enough for me.
Hey, Melissa Bergeson, one of our good friends. Rhea is Jokinen in a first-line center again in the NHL. No, he's a third-line center playing on Nashville's top line. Ooh, sad face. Hashtag there's a difference.
There is a difference. It's true.
That's tough, man. That's tough in the West.
Down the middle there. All right. Listen, everybody. You guys are great. Thanks for all the nice notes about us coming back today. It was very exciting to read all that jive, and we missed you too. Back on Wednesday, where we'll do a little bit of ye olde going postal, and then we'll see about Friday.
But I think I can do Friday. Wednesday. I think I can do Friday.
I got to see if I can do Friday.
I think so.
I don't know for sure. I will tell you this.
Mr. Busy Pants.
Wheels are turning on trying to see a certain movie about a certain group of people who may or may not guard the galaxy on Thursday night in IMAX. Guardians of the Galaxy, ladies and gentlemen. Thursday night.
Oh, God, that's your big plan, Thursday night?
Cannot wait.
Listen, dude, do yourself a favor and go to documentaryheaven.com tonight.
All right, I'll go to the thing.
It's spectacular. It really is.
Starting to binge watch Arrow, by the way, for those of you who care about such things. I've had enough people tell me that it's a really good show that I'm picking and choosing from season one than trying to do season two. Also, a show that I know will make my our Canadian listeners very happy that I've gotten into. That would be a
Hobo?
Show called not Hobo. That would be a show called Nathan for You on Comedy Central, in which Canadian comedian Nathan Fielder,
He of formerly of The Daily Show, I believe. It's an ingenious setup. It's the second season of it. I've watched them all now. I couldn't get enough of it. It's one of those shows that spoofs the shows where the guys try to go to businesses and help a business turn their stuff around. Except it's completely deadpan, fake documentary style, where he goes to these businesses and in some cases comes up with disastrous ideas, but in most cases comes up with ingenious ideas. And I'll give away one, which is by far, I think, the funniest.
Get it?
He comes up with a way for a gas station to charge, like, $1.99 a gallon for gas, okay? Mm-hmm. And the guy's like, well, how do you do it? And he's like, well, you do it with a rebate. You put $1.99 on your sign outside and say, with rebate. And the way they get around the rebate rules, the fine print on the rebate is, in order to cash in the rebate and get your money back, you have to, like, hike up the largest mountain in California, find a mailbox in the wilderness, and put your rebate slip in there. And it's like a two-day hike. And some people attempted to do it, but then I won't tell you what happened. But so that's the way they get around the rebate thing, is you can get $1.99 gas, but you have to pay full price, and then get your rebate money by climbing California's largest mountain.
It's fantastic. Isn't he the guy that did that Starbucks goof too?
Yes, dumb
okay,
Starbucks.
I know that guy. I'm trying to think, like, what the hell is that guy?
That's on this week's episode, I think, is dumb Starbucks. But yeah,
All right. I know.
Go on demand right now, and Nathan For You is ridiculously funny. It's my favorite summer viewing so far. All right, I think we're all
it's
caught
a beautiful
up.
Thing.
So we'll come back on Wednesday and move the
no
ball forward and talk about that Daniel Winnick signing.
Oh, that's huge. You want to get some, like, old timers on the show?
Yeah. Oh, are you saying we might need some guests for Wednesday's show? Yes.
Okay. All right, I'll talk to some people.
Talk to as many people as you can, or else it'll be... Here are the top five teams we think Peter Mueller might head to.
What's P.K. Subban's number going to be in arbitration? I do want to talk Wednesday about Noah Hanifin. Remind me of that. I'll talk about Hanifin on Wednesday.
Okay.
This kid is... Awful. He's good. Anyway, we'll talk about that on Wednesday.
At the end of the show, I think we're deep into it, so I don't think anyone can rip off the idea now because we've already put the wheels in motion.
What's up?
I will reveal to you, ladies and gentlemen, those who have stayed this long, an hour and 26 minutes into this podcast, I will reveal to you the Puck Daddy August project that we always do every August. We do a 30-team project, and here is the project for this summer. Is the Puck Daddy's, it's called Puck Daddy's Most Disappointing Summer Project. That's the working title. In which we ask diehard fans of each of the National Hockey League's teams, some bloggers, some writers, some fans, some personalities, to give us some of the most disappointing things in their franchise's history. Most disappointing player.
Franchise. Oh, yeah.
Most disappointing coach. Moment. Most disappointing... look, be it sweater.
Do you have anyone on your staff handling the tricky issue of historical oversight, sir?
You mean like an ombudsman for hockey history? Are you saying that the Montreal person may not be dipping far enough into the past to come up with the real disappointments? Yeah,
if the most disappointing thing is the presence of Andre Rassico, I'm guessing you're not going into deep enough water. That's all I'm saying.
Are you saying that we may have to put the Society for Hockey Insight and History on our payroll for this project as ombudsman?
You may just have to. We can nominate someone internally from the society to handle historical oversight for all 30 NHL teams. But we can talk about this offline. I'm sure you'll find our rates reasonable, Greg. Very reasonable.
Oh, you may believe that Alexander Daigle is the biggest disappointing player in Ottawa history, but may I remind you about Jacques Rougeau of the Silver Sevens?
That kind of stuff. That's pretty much what we're going over. Did you say Jacques Rougeau of the Silver Sevens, by the way? Like the Mountie? That was your pull?
Oh, and finally, speaking of rabbit holes, Occasionally, we talk awesome. About writers that we love in this show. I went down the rabbit hole with one that I've been reading since I was in college. You have to know him as in your former capacity as a wrestling guru. Scott Keith.
I don't know that I know Scott Keith.
Scott Keith. All right, if you're a wrestling fan.
Why should I know Scott Keith? Hang on.
Google Scott Keith Netcop Rants. This is a guy who's been writing about wrestling since the news group days, and has reviews of pretty much every pay-per-view ever made in every federation. And I sometimes go back and revisit like the ones from like the late 80s, early 90s that were atrocious, especially in WCW. He's amazing. Just a very, very insightful and snarky writer, and knows the business back and front. If you're a wrestling fan,
I'm on his blog right now. It looks awesome. Scott's
if you've
blog
never read Scott Keith and his snark rants about wrestling, please do. I was reading one about like the Bash at the Beach, where it was the Great American Bash. It was a scaffold match that he gave a -5 stars to.
Oof.
The scaffold matches were because they got rid of the one thing about scaffold matches that were great, which is people falling off the scaffold. It became capture the flag. Nobody actually fell
off the
scaffold.
These guys were terrified.
Right, but why even have it then?
Because it looks imposing when you walk in the arena. Like, oh, the scaffolds are up. They're gonna fight on the scaffold.
They opened the pay per view with a scaffold match. I'm not a professional booker, sir, but I'd say that's a mistake.
Yeah, probably not good. Although I've been to cards like house shows where. I remember one time my buddy Dave, who runs a promotion out in BC, every match was a cage match. It's like, Dave, what the hell is that? He goes, we're too lazy to take down the cage. He said, every match is a cage match.
Oh, also finally, I really enjoyed Tommy Dreamer. Tommy Dreamer did a two-parter on Stone Cold's podcast. That was really good, too.
Oh, no way. Yeah, Dreamer's good. Good story. I haven't listened to Austin's really podcast. Good. The last one I listened to was Paul Heyman. The Paul Heyman appearances.
Honestly.
Paul Heyman's, I know he's always the best. But Dreamer was on there. Okay, I'll go listen to Tommy Dreamer. I'm guessing there's tons of great ECW stuff, right?
Awesome stuff.
All right.
ECW.
It's good.
All right, everybody. That's the show for today. Thanks for sticking around. Hopefully you were able to use the elliptical a few times on this podcast, or perhaps walk your dog 7 times.
Yeah.
Considering the length of this one. Thanks.
Section 328. Scott Keith is writing for Sporting News now, too.
Oh, sweet.
Sold out, man. It's gone all mainstream, like me.
Congratulations to Scott Keith. And thanks to Kyle Dubas for joining us on the show today. Hopefully a man that will remain a friend of the podcast, even though he can't really say anything of interest anymore because it's all tampering. we'll hopefully have him back later on.
I loved his go-to on Thornton, too. Well, all I can say is he's a former Sault Ste. Marie Greyhound great. It's tactically true.
He should say that
kinda,
about anything.
I kind of thought that if he was going to end up anywhere as his first job in the NHL, it would be Carolina, just because of the Ron Francis Association, another great former Greyhound. Kind of thought they would have landed there.
I love the idea that, like, you know, someone will randomly ask him in like a conversation about Steven Stamkos. So, what do you think about Steven Stamkos as a Leaf? I mean, his possession numbers are off the charts, numbers boy. All I can say is that he was a legendary member of the Sarnia Sting.
Yeah, he was tough to play against in the OHL those 2 years that he was there. They never got past the first round of the playoffs, but those Sting teams were tough to play against.
Oh, yeah. All right. Thanks,
everybody, for
joining us.
Sarnia Sting, hang on. We always like getting people on the radar, right? And we told you about Connor McHockey a couple of years ago, right? All you're talking about. The other name to keep in your hip pocket is a defenseman for the Sarnia Sting. His name is Jacob Chychrun. He is the son of former NHLer Jeff Chychrun. He will probably go first overall next year.
And Danielle writes in something I completely forgot about. We should have probably led the show with this. Sure. She asks, no mention of Tim Peel on Twitter. Yes, Tim Peel was on Twitter for about 15 minutes while I was on vacation.
Yeah. Yep.
And actually followed me, which is really weird. But evidently the NHL said, no, we can't have an active... The NHL evidently said we can't have an active referee on social media.
Yep, so, I know. Boo to the NHL. Good for Tim for getting on to make himself part of the conversation.
Yeah, sure. It would have been amazing. It would have been one of the most popular Twitter feeds in the history of hockey, I think, had he stayed on.
Are you kidding me? 100%.
Imagine, Can you imagine how many follows he'd get if he at any point just dropped a tiny, even half-hearted explanation about a goalie interference penalty he called?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. Mm-hmm. Or bounce a puck on a face-off on an opening draw. Oh, yeah, and you hear about it. But I'll tell you what, if Peel would have been able to join social media and have a profile on Twitter, a lot of people would have been turned around on how they feel about Tim Peel. All you need to do, folks, is ask referees about their calls. Because right now, he just exists as a target, right? Because he can't fight back.
Yeah.
It's all he exists as a target. And so he gets on social media, and the NHL says, nope, can't do it.
What I mean, you're proffering that people would stop feeling so vicious about Tim Peel if they knew he was a human being and not an official, which of course, and not just a referee, a striped shirt on the ice, which of course misses the fact that referees aren't actually people but clones grown in petri dishes.
Everyone's just a version of which referee from the past, then, Greg.
Paul Stewart is the last human-born referee baby. Everyone else was made in a petri dish.
Hey, did you see his piece, by the way, Paul Stewart, about Eric Lindros?
I did. Wasn't that amazing?
About how I'm not giving him any more breaks. Yeah. That's it. It's by the book.
And he had, what was it, a bunch of posters for him to autograph for charity?
Yeah, and he wouldn't do it.
And then Lindros threw them in the garbage.
Yeah.
Threw them in the garbage, he said, yeah.
It's all from once. I remember Paul, and this is on the air, so it's not out of school. I remember he told me once we were talking on the air about players that he hated officiating against, and one of the guys was Chris Gratton. And I said, why Chris Gratton? He said, well, he used to beak referees nonstop, which is fine. You expect to get it on the ice, but he would spit on my skates on faceoffs. Like, I've heard of, like, sentiment, like, spitting on the other guy's stick to distract him, but who spits on a referee's skate at the draw?
I'll say this about Lindros after reading that story. Just a bit of advice. I would ask David Backes about the ins and outs of adopting puppies. You may need a little bit more image rehab before you hop into that hall, sir. That's all I'm saying. Puppies, maybe kittens, something other, ducklings. Oh, ducklings. Who would turn Eric Lindros away from the Hall of Fame if there was a picture of him nuzzling baby ducks? No one. Yeah. I'm just saying you may need that. Maybe a little bit of boost.
I think Eric just had his first kid. Now that I can, we were just talking about that at a barbecue on Saturday, I believe. Yep.
That's amazing.
Yep, with a French-Canadian girl. So he married, to all you conspiracy theorists.
Was the baby born head down?
Oh, man. Conky jokes? Said the guy that called
him. No, not a conky joke. Not a conky joke. A skating irresponsibly joke. That is not a conky joke, sir. I can't. Okay. I'm not joking about the after effect. The after effect. That was a skating irresponsibly joke.
Oh, man. The podcast takes a dark turn.
That's hard. Like I said, Greg Wyshynski, if you ever want to get the Elmer Ferguson Award and get to that Hall of Fame, you better start nuzzling some duckies, man. You said some things that'll never get
done. Sorry, Greg. Yeah. I don't know. They're letting. You're not going to be the. See, Kyle Dubas was kind of the Neil Armstrong for the analytics groups getting into the NHL's, sacred halls. I don't know that you're going to be the Neil Armstrong of bloggers into the Hall of Fame with comments like that, sir. You may be Buzz Aldrin. You might be. Who knows? Just don't know that you're going to be Neil Armstrong.
Yeah. They're going to put me and Myrtle next to each other and be like, let's see. Who would we be comfortable with being the vanguard of blogging in the Hockey Hall of Fame?
Hang on.
Quasi-concussion jokes or the tall, stately Canadian?
let me ask you one thing. If you do make it in and you win the Ferg, will you promise me now that I can do your induction speech?
Oh, yes. Okay. Absolutely.
Done. Then I'm starting the campaign. Get Wish in.
I want you to know, though, you actually said speech and not roast. They are two different things.
No, not necessarily. No. I've watched enough.
I promise that if I if I won the Elmer Ferguson Award and was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame as a pioneering blogger, I would in fact wear an Atlanta Thrashers hat on my plaque.
Which defunct? Yeah, would you wear all? What would you wear to it? Would you wear like all antiquated teams?
Actually, that's
like
a lie.
Barons
I'd wear the
Whalers.
Whale. I'd wear the whale. That's obviously what I would do. Yeah, protest.
There'd be no devil's garb for you.
If I got the Elmer Ferguson Award, do I take an official picture with the actual Hall of Famers? Like where we do that thing where we stick out our fists with our ring on them? Do we do that?
No, you actually get a luncheon in the afternoon.
So what you're saying is that winning the Elmer Ferguson Award is like getting a technical achievement Oscar. They just have a separate ceremony for the people who aren't worthy to be in the same room as Clooney and Pitt.
A credit roll is going to break. That's what you get. But it is a nice luncheon, as I understand it.
Earlier today, we honored our most important members of the hockey family, the media.
Hey man, you know what? You know what's always.
Really I just got to, switched back to the other radio. It's time to go. Bye.
Oh jeez, Craig got punted again. All right, that's it. I guess we've run out of time here. Oh, 3:40. Look at that. All right, everybody, we're back again on Wednesday. Me, your buddy Jeff, right? The guy you like, and that asshole Greg. All right, talk to you Wednesday.